Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet and educator Kirsten Wasson. Wasson is an assistant professor in the Department of English at Ithaca College. She received her PhD from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Her work has appeared in many literary magazines and journals, including the North American Review, the Seneca Review, and the Kansas City Quarterly. Her first collection of poetry, called Almost Everything Takes Forever, was published last fall by Antrim House Press. And I welcome you to the show, Kirsten.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I want to talk about what initially got you involved in writing and poetry. Do you remember?
I started writing pretty young. I remember writing stories in elementary school. I remember writing a poem in fourth grade about the color blue. And I got some encouragement from teachers and parents. I was lucky that way. And just continued, I suppose. I wrote a lot of the time like anyone, for the reasons anyone writes, just sort of a need to express things that ordinary language does not convey.
Yeah, I know a lot of poets have told me that. So did it take you a while to find a voice?
I don't think that was what it took me a while to find so much. Of course, you know, I was writing as a teenager or an undergraduate. My voice was, like most undergraduates, angst-ridden and self-involved. No offense to all of my wonderful students. For me, it was more about learning how to hear music and how to convey music. I always felt that I had a voice that seemed close to my voice, but not exactly, but authentic, not too poetic-y. But it took me a long time. I'm not a very musical person, although I listen to a lot of music, to, I think, really pay attention to rhythm and to rhyme, for that matter.
Yeah. I know, poetry to me is a lot like photography, too. I mean, you have to learn how to do a composition, and you have to learn how to deal with the light and the darkness.
Right, yeah.
So that's very interesting that you needed to find the music.
Yeah, and it involved, you know, reading out loud, reading other poets, and reading myself, my own work, just sort of habitually.
Uh-huh. And how do you describe your work? I remember an interview with the poet Billy Collins where he said he described his poems as modes of travel that take the reader to unexpected places. And how do you think of your work?
That's an interesting description. I like that. I guess I don't think about that very much. I don't know if I think about sort of the genre of my work, but I guess you're asking that in a more sort of philosophical way. I guess I think not so much about traveling as about maybe bringing something invisible into visibility. Things that are not quite present, but we can feel them or sense them, and trying to unearth them and bring them into the light.
So you're almost trying to bring shadows into the light, or make something solid.
Maybe things that are sort of buried by the quotidian experiences of life, which can be very distracting.
Yeah, absolutely. Gosh. Now you wrote a nonfiction article for Ascent magazine called Articles May Shift in Flight, where you talk about having to shuttle back and forth between your divorced parents. To talk to us about that, and how has that affected you as a writer?
Well, I guess I'd begin by saying it certainly contributed to my being a fairly interior person. People who know me do know me as an extrovert, but I think I spend a lot of time, probably like most writers, in my head, traveling back and forth once a month from Illinois to New Jersey. Being alone on the plane put me in a kind of strange head, and I did that, as I say, once a month from the time I was 8 until the time I was about 17. So I think that probably made a part of my brain and soul very practiced at thinking about what I was just describing, which is the invisible and the things that I perceived that other people didn't seem to be perceiving necessarily. And I suppose it made me someone who has a lot of conversations with myself, and that's probably where a lot of the poetry comes from.
And I also notice in your collection that it almost seems like many writers, you're searching for home.
Yeah, that's what it says in the back of the book, I noticed.
But I see a lot of poems where you talk about home, now that you have actually found one in some ways, right, with your son. And
yeah, but I am very restless, and I think I am always thinking about being somewhere else, which may not be the healthiest M.O., but it's interesting that you would say that about home. I think I certainly have grown to love Ithaca, and it's a wonderful place to raise a child, as most people know, whether or not they have one. But I think I've spent a lot of time, particularly in January and February and March, dreaming about being elsewhere.
Welcome to the Ithaca Club, right? Yeah. How interesting that is about home. Because you do, I mean, I don't know if you've noticed it or even been cognizant of it, but you do write about it a lot. Home and memories of your mother and...
Yeah, I do. I think, as with a lot of poetry, that's probably in part because of a sense of loss of home. My mother, quite early, she was just 66 and I was 38. And I suppose maybe because my parents were divorced, and I think having a sense of loss of home brings it more into the fore. You know, what was that? And how did it smell and taste and feel, and how can I recapture it? It's gone, but I need to bring it out.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think you do a great job of it.
Thank you.
I do want to have you read from Almost Everything Takes Forever. I want you to read a poem called Now and Then. Do you want to tell us about it first?
Sure. This is certainly inspired by loss, not mine so pointedly, but my mother's. Her husband died, not my father, but my stepfather, very suddenly in a car accident. And when I went to visit her over the couple of years after that, while she was
learning to be a widow,
She seemed to be just sort of feeling her way through life in a completely different manner. She seemed like a very different person, and in a lot of ways sort of halting and careful. And that was not my mother's style. My mother was very assertive, direct, always on the go kind of person. So I guess that's what this poem's about.
Mm-hmm.
Now and then. Since I saw her last, my mother attended a cat show, an open house. Signs she is recovering, becoming a widow. Alone again, she feeds neighborhood tomcats sniffing her toes like wild carnivores. Hands full, my mother takes in newspapers, days piled on the porch. Last time I followed her around as if guessing her next step over a spotless bare wood floor, her small feet never in shoes, covered ground upstairs, down. The tabby next door licked her heels, a taste for salt in animal condolence. I worried she thought of a new house, one where we'd own time together, girlhood reorganized. Now my mother sleeps with doors unlocked, an invitation to another life, some notion of the future. In corners, cat eyes gleam through night. I picture them meeting up with the old days, whiskering at the past, discerning the human shape of loss, sniffing, neutral.
Wow. Did she get a chance to read that? Did you share any of your poetry with her?
I did. It was quite a different poem at that time. The cats played a smaller role back then. Now they seem to have taken it over. Yeah, my mother was an English teacher and a poet herself. So she certainly appreciated reading my poems, but it was very often as an editor as much as a proud mother.
An appreciator of the art, huh?
Like, is that word quite the word you meant to use?
I think that would be a hard thing to take.
Well, I got used to it.
Well, to tell us what some of your rituals are as a writer. Did you write every day? Do you carry a journal around with you?
I carry a journal often, and especially, this goes back to the question you asked me about home, especially when I'm away. I find being away from home is when I'm most inspired. I would like to say that I write every day, but I don't. I go through really lush, fertile periods, and then I go through bone dry, dead periods. And of course, it's often connected to what's going on in my life. I just recently moved from the house where I had lived for 11 years, and I'm, knock wood, going through a lush, fertile period now, just because, again, thinking about that home and what that home meant, where my son mostly grew up and where I was married and I'm no longer, and adjusting to an apartment, which I'm enjoying very much, but is a strange new space, has me writing a lot. So I've been writing every day the last couple of months, but I'm not the kind of writer who is disciplined enough to write every day. I get too impatient, as my title suggests, and frustrated when I'm not getting good ideas. So I wait for the lush periods.
Wow. Well, it sounds like you have found home in your writing in many ways. A lot of writers I've heard do not like to write when they travel. They could only write when they're home. So I find that very interesting, too, that you have made the writing your home.
Wow, that is really opposite for me. I think I feel easily stifled. So when I'm seeing new things and I'm moving around, I feel, as you say, at home.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's sort of the irony of the essay you mentioned, Articles in Flight. I'm writing a longer piece about that, which is that I feel very comfortable in airports. I feel very comfortable in the airplane suspended above the earth.
That is so funny.
Antithetical to, I think, how a lot of people feel. But that kind of suspension from the ordinary is where I'm most comfortable.
But it's also a hideout where you can be anonymous.
Yes.
Did you put a lot of energy into performance? Is that something that you think about in regard to the writing as a great part of what the writing is?
No. As I told you before this interview, I'm quite nervous, and I'm quite nervous when I give readings. It feels like the poetry has a life of its own, and I almost prefer it to carry on that life without me, so I would probably be happy if someone else read my work. The performance part feels like a completely, well, not completely separate, but somewhat separate from the work itself.
Wow, that's interesting to me, because a lot of poets do like to read in a neutral voice so people can make up their own mind.
Mm-hmm.
Or read dramatically so that you know exactly what's happening. But it sounds to me like you don't want to do either.
Neutral would certainly be more the way I would describe. But I don't think there's ever a neutral reading. So I think your voice is always indicating something.
Yeah, it has to be.
Even if you're putting on a kind of neutrality, you're saying, I'm not going to tell you that this part is sad or that this part is funny. But you better figure it out.
Yeah. But I remember when I was young and used to go to poetry readings, that there was this strange technique that poets would use.
Yeah.
They'd go in, up and down.
Mm-hmm.
That sing song, I'm not going to go into the garden. I'm not going to take you into the yard. You know, I mean, I couldn't stand that. And to me, that's a way of turning people off instead of keeping people neutral, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I used to think people were trained to read that way, but I do think it was a technique.
Yeah, it is a technique. Do you like the way Dylan Thomas reads?
You know, I can't remember. Mm-hmm. I've heard the recordings. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. It's pretty dramatic, isn't it?
It's very dramatic. It's very performative. But nevertheless, I love it. I love listening to him.
I sort of like it when people act out and make dramatic what should be dramatic.
Yeah. With him, it almost feels to me like he is speaking in tongues.
Mm.
I feel like he's taken over by the words, the language.
Yeah. There's a lot of debate about whether that's good or bad way to convey your work, you know?
True.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't want us to run out of time. I do want you to read another from Almost Everything Takes Forever. This one called April Fools.
Okay. This is a poem quite recent that I wrote when I was trying to sell my house, and it took...
Almost forever?
Almost forever. And it was around the time of approaching big birthday. So the poem begins with a dream, and I'm lying in bed and I hear icicles falling off of the eaves of the house and I'm sort of half awake. April Fools. Almost 50, I wake to a sound, ruinous smashing. House breaking? Icicles falling. My dream still present, walking with my mother through bog muck, a soupy mess that we don't mind, the smock smooch of boots in and out of primeval ground, willing us on and on, discussing children, one each, and men, left or lost. We misremember their efforts, though not particulars of touch, the shape of fingers. Stink comforts us, slogging through murky swales, fading to pillow as shingles of ice bomb my dream. She's disappointed by my approaching 50. Rotten thing for a daughter to turn like that. Still, she dismisses her disappearance. My tall mother, dead and impatient, in turtleneck and short skirt, hiking the marsh while I try to sell an old house. She's speaking of melting, the ground soft. Almost everything takes forever, you know. Then she spots a green shoot, white bud, a snowdrop. Look.
That's great. If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Kirsten Wasson. We're having her read from her book, Almost Everything Takes Forever. Can you talk to us a little bit about who your influences are as other writers?
Well, I suppose the poet who in some ways is the most important to me is Rilke. Because of the thing I mentioned before about making the invisible visible. He's so concerned with, well, spiritual life and the dead and ghosts.
I think his stuff is amazing.
So that's always spoken to me very, very dramatically. I actually had a chance, I have a poem about it, to go to the castle in Italy, and that was very meaningful to me. Contemporary poets, I like Kay Ryan very much. I like Denise Levertov. I like Mark Doty. I like Mark Doty a lot. I guess I like poetry that is direct, unpretentious, but also does have the musicality that I was talking about, because that's good for my ear. I mean, I try to read before I write, sort of like doing finger exercises on the piano,
yeah,
just to get that part of my brain flowing.
And into that different realm. Now, you've written a lot about Jewish identity, and I saw that you've written essays and you have excerpts from your life or something in books. Is Jewish identity a great part of your writing life?
No, I'm not Jewish, but I was raised by thoroughly fervent atheists.
Ah.
So, word to the wise out there, if you raise your child as an atheist fervently, she will spend the rest of her life looking for meaningful spiritual life.
That's interesting.
And I married a man who was Jewish, is Jewish, and we did a fair number of ceremonial, ritualized activities involving food and holidays in the Jewish tradition, and our son went to Hebrew school and had a bar mitzvah, which was really remarkably wonderful. So it's something I'm just on the periphery of.
Mm-hmm. So you never converted?
No.
I was thinking that perhaps you had.
No, not really sure about conversion. I mean, particularly in the case of Jewish identity, there's so much cultural history there that is not mine, that it would feel very false. And I mean, I never considered it anyway, but my dissertation was on a number of Russian Jewish women, mm-hmm, who were immigrating to the United States at the turn of the century. So I became very interested in that before I even was raising a son with some of the tradition.
Yeah, that's interesting to me, because I didn't notice it a lot in your biography, mm-hmm, in many different places. I was thinking, okay. Well, before we run out of time, I do want you to read another poem. This is a longer one. This one I find really moving. It's called Timepiece.
Okay, just a little background. This was shortly after my mother died very, very suddenly, unexpectedly. And in the poem, I'm with my son, who is 7, and I was certainly kind of in a state of shock for a couple of years after her passing. And my son was sort of aware that Grandma had died, but at 7, that's a pretty vague thing. So this poem is about the time period of after my mother died and sort of recuperating and thinking about her a lot with my son around. Timepiece. After spacemanning around the yard all afternoon, my son eats a crescent cookie on our walk downtown. We return in dark, he mad dashing to corners, waiting for me to cross. At home, his head drops on my neck, heavy bones and feet hang. This is gravity, Mom. Most of the time, I am these days pushed away from kisses, the old sneaky looks, Oedipal longings on the decline at one end. Tonight, I pointed out Orion the warrior, trying on the male perspective. Carrying him up the stairs is almost more weight than I can bear. At 7, Noah knows one black coat from another by smell. This is Mom's. Another time, his nose to my mother's watch. That's Grandma's. Her death has not fazed him. He wishes we could find for Orion a head in the sky. I try to know why my mother's free will failed, apparently. If you keep going, would you get to the end of the world? His Columbus to my catching up, a couple whose days are numbered. Noah's tan neck, a place still tolerating kisses. Ashes, ashes, we fall, and darkness woos me to bed. My mother's watch ticks, Orion's belt glows in the night heavy with stars, the lights we can't see. My son sleeps in his room, and in the hallway the moon blazes with white wakefulness.
That's great.
Thank you.
That's really a wonderful piece. You know, I've often wondered about writing personal stuff that includes, like, a child. Did you ever think that you should censor yourself? Or, you know, how a lot of people talk about, I should have asked permission before I wrote about my son's, you know, health problems or whatever. What do you think about that?
Complicated question. I haven't thought about it in relation to poetry very much.
Mm.
I did write for the Ithaca Times on and off, but overall it was almost 10 years that I did it. I had a monthly column called In the Loop, and it was pretty personal. And people would say, how can you expose yourself that way? It just doesn't bother me, because while most of the things were true, I don't get embarrassed very easily. And I also sort of felt it was a persona. It was something I was writing.
Uh-huh.
Yes, those things happened to me, but that's still not really who I am. But you're asking me about writing about someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose I do think about that. I'm writing a memoir now, though, so I'm sort of up to my elbows in writing about people I know. I do remember that my son, who has read all of the poems about himself, but when I was writing the article for the Ithaca Times, I wrote about a love letter that he received from a girl when he was 7, and he, at that point, could read it. He had not been able to read anything I wrote before, and he made it very clear, this cannot happen again. So I am conscious of it, but I also think that unless you're writing something cruel, it's just the way
it's part of life.
Writing, yeah.
Yeah. Is your son a writer at all?
No, he is a painter and a musician, and
quite
fabulous at both. He's certainly got the artist's soul.
Oh, so he inherited the creativity. I saw in your biography that you used to write restaurant reviews, too. Was that an entirely separate persona as well?
It was very similar to the In the Loop persona, sort of brash and somewhat self-deprecating, over the top. My restaurant reviews tended to be over the top. I love to talk about food because I love food. I love to eat. I love to cook. And so I took some pleasure in talking about food in a manner that was, I mean, sometimes sort of mythological or biblical, you know, to make the most of it.
Well, that makes it more interesting, because I was wondering if you thought of your restaurant reviews as creative writing.
Yes.
Or was it utilitarian to try to get people to... Okay. Most definitely it was creative writing.
Creative, yeah.
Do you see yourself ever writing fiction or novels or anything?
Not very imaginative.
Yeah, but you are, because you're taking these shadows, which we talked about in the beginning, and turning them into something concrete.
Yeah, I have not written fiction since I was in my 20s. I read fiction all the time. I love it, but I just do not feel like I go there. I feel like my perceptions are about things that are there. You just can't see them. I'm really not very good at coming up with a storyline, for instance.
Yeah, and making up people.
Yeah.
I can't imagine being able to do that either. You have some new poems, and I want you to read one of the new ones. This one's called Dog Sitting, and I find it a lot different than some of your other stuff.
That's interesting. I'll have to ask you about that. This poem is about my dog. I think I should probably dedicate it. Felix, this is for you. It's got a little epigraph, Dog Sitting, from a Buddhist writer. If we enter the realm of dogs, we enter the state free of price and comparison. It is a humble seat, a place with no need for confirmation. All is like space. This is from a book called Light Comes Through by a man named Sigar Konkatrul. I came to dogs late in life. The perpetual slobbery snoutliness repulsed until the age of 40, when snouts spoke to me, nuzzling skin, my darkening soul. A decade I've spent with my dog, more time than in marriage. A long time to spend with a creature so pleased to smell every filthy thing life has to offer. Mud, rot, death. I should have looked for that in a man. A friend sends an email that she is God-sitting, meaning dog, of course. Same kind of attendance, I imagine. The breath, the watching, barking at squirrels, the occasional exhausted sigh. My dog and I lie on the floor, the end of a day, holding too much and not enough. He knows nothing, and I, the all-seeing, I meant to say, I, his know-nothing. We parse dusk helix, my toes as space surrounds. Sit. Stay. Good. Dog.
The reason why I think that seems so different is because it's so funny and sarcastic. Most of your other stuff does not seem quite so.
My dog is funny.
Yeah, but is this the start of a new collection, or have you written quite a few new pieces?
I have, and I suppose now that you mention it, Tish, they all do kind of have that sarcastic tone. Yeah, uh-huh. I mean, the poems I was mentioning to you that I'm writing about having moved, I just finished a poem about leaving the house and packing things up and trying to get rid of stuff, and now I'm writing a poem about being in this new space and feeling dislocated. And both of them do have this kind of voice. Now that you mention it, I hadn't really thought about it.
Yeah, so maybe you've gone through all the stages, you know, that people are supposed to go through, grieving and anger.
Yeah. And then the final stage is sarcasm?
I'm assuming that perhaps for you it might be. Can we talk a little bit about teaching?
Sure.
I know you've been teaching for quite a number of years. What do you try to instill in some of your students?
Well, I suppose in terms of the material, I do what most literature professors do, which is to equip them with language about metaphor and simile and symbol and nuance so that students can experience literary language in a way that they haven't before. Mm-hmm. Often students find things either indecipherable, especially poetry, or they're missing a lot, and it's just a matter of honing your skills of perception. It takes practice. It's like anything else. A lot of students come to a literature class and think, well, either you really get this stuff or you don't. Mm-hmm. And I try to minimize that attitude by showing them that anyone can learn these skills and appreciate and get more out of a piece of writing. The other thing I do, I think, is teach my undergraduates not to be embarrassed. Especially freshmen are very self-conscious, nervous group of people. Mm-hmm. And since, as I said before, I don't get embarrassed very easily, I sort of demonstrate that in class. I tend to leap around a lot and tell a lot of jokes and tell embarrassing stories about myself in order to get them to loosen up and enjoy the classroom, so that classroom time is not just sitting and taking notes.
I bet you inspire them with that. Now, we are almost out of time. Do you have any readings coming up? Anything that we can tell people to?
I do, but it's not in Ithaca. I will be reading at a bookstore I've forgotten the name of in Buffalo in March, and I don't have a set plan yet, but Antrim House is having my publishers having a group reading in Glastonbury, Connecticut in May, so I'll be doing that.
So you will be making the circuit somewhere, perhaps somewhere local.
And I will be reading at Buffalo Street Books in connection with their nonfiction readings they have. I'll be doing that later on in spring. I don't have a date yet.
Great. Do you have any contact information? Do you have a website or anything?
I don't, and I understand that that's what writers do now, so I'm going to get on that.
So they can get in touch with you through your publisher if they want to get in touch with you, huh?
Yes, or
Ithaca College. That's right. Well, Kristen Wasson, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you and have you read your work.
Thank you, Tish. It's been a real pleasure.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.